Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
Hey, I'm joined today on The Enemies List by Gevin Reynolds. Gevin is a young guy coming up in Democratic politics who is making a big difference. He has worked in the Biden White House, has written for and advised the vice president. And I wanted to talk to him today a little bit about where he sees the 2024 campaign, where he sees the role of the vice president, who the right wing has tried to make into the worst boogeyman I've ever seen them try to make anybody into, and get his flavor on where we stand with young voters, with African-American voters, with the whole coalition Joe Biden needs to put together to win this year. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Gevin.
Rick, thanks very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Well, let's start right out about where you see the race right now.
Yeah, I'm feeling really optimistic right now, Rick. Look, I think we've been at a very complicated point in our politics over the past 4 years, over the past 3 years, I'll say. When the president and vice president took office, you know, they took office under some very challenging circumstances. There were a number of, you know, crises that were going on in our country. You know, we had COVID, obviously, as a public health crisis. We had, you know, an economic crisis. Our country was, you know, in a tailspin, you know, thanks to how the prior administration managed the pandemic in large part. And of course, and I know this is something we want to talk about as well, you know, we had a crisis around racial justice. And that wasn't new, obviously, but I think all of us know that in 2020, that sort of, you know, came to a head. And I think over the past 3 years, you know, I've been a part of the administration, I think, making gains in those three crises. And right now on the outside, you know, I'm continuing to see them shift right from purely governing now to governing and campaigning. The State of the Union recently, I think for me, was a huge turning point in this campaign. We had, you know, a number of things that felt like were going not in our favor prior to that point. You know, I think for a long time, the economy still was struggling to fully make that rebound that a lot of people were looking for. You know, I think the president was, you know, very unfairly dogged by, you know, criticisms about his age, about his fitness for the job, about his ability to serve, you know, 4 more years. You know, there, you know, continue to be concerns about, you know, what's going on at the southern border. And I think a lot of people looked at the State of the Union as the president's opportunity to come out of the gate and to reassure the nation that he was up to the job. And I think, I don't think I'm the only one who believes that he came out and did that, right? You know, we've seen since the State of the Union, we've seen a number of polls, poll after poll, you know, turning in the president's favor. And obviously, I don't want to overstate anything here, and I don't read into the polls too much anyway. But even on fundraising, right, we're seeing right now, you know, in terms of cash on hand, the Biden campaign has, you know, double the amount of cash on hand, you know, more than double than the Trump campaign. Tonight, there's going to be a fundraiser in New York. And, you know, the Biden campaign is expecting to bring in $25 million. That's more than the Trump campaign raised in February overall. You know, right. This is all in one night. And, you know, and I think a lot of the issues that, you know, we were really concerned about, you know, like I said, going into the State of the Union around that time, I think the president has successfully removed so many lines of attack from the other side, right? He's shown that he's serious about, you know, solving what's going on at the southern border. The Republicans, Donald Trump, they're not, right? And so I think that's become crystal clear. Like I said, I think his performance at the State of the Union and since then have put to bed, you know, a lot of those criticisms about his fitness and age. And people now see what I saw, you know, when I worked, you know, at the White House, and the economy is just continuing to strengthen. And I think people are starting to feel that. I think a lot of people too, Rick, the last thing I'll say before we move on is that I think a lot of people too are still very much asleep when it comes to this election. You and I, you know, we, you know,
pay a little more attention than most people.
Correct. Exactly. You know, we eat, breathe, and sleep this stuff, but a lot of people are not going to wake up, in some cases, until the summer, but in many cases, not until October. And I think by then, a lot is going to change. So we sit here having this conversation now. Let's check in, you know, in a few months. But, you know, I feel like I'll be even more optimistic by then as Trump continues to flounder and Biden and the Democrats continue to do what they need to do to win this election.
Well, I mean, look, there is a known phenomena in polling where it takes good economic news between 3 and 7 months to really sink into voters and change their minds. And we look back in history about a lot of these things. You know, you look back at 1984. At this point, the economy had been improving over the winter of 83 and the spring of 84. Reagan was behind. Reagan was not the, you know, but by the time the summer hit, the economic prosperity had started to trickle into people's heads and they believed it. And it made it very hard. It was the same situation when you had George Bush running against Al Gore. When they started the election, the economy was booming and it looked like Al Gore would be the, you know, the third Clinton term. It would be an easy ride. And then the things changed and it gave George W. a predicate in that campaign to change the ballgame. So, you know, we look at all these economic numbers and they really are starting to, people are getting it. Where it, now it's down to the Republicans, like, well, gas is still too high. Okay, well, it's not raging inflation that came from Donald Trump's mishandling of the economy. It's not all the knock-on effects of COVID, as you mentioned. So, yeah, I do think we're getting to the point where people are seeing that economic is not working for Republicans like they thought it would, which is why they've gone back to all the immigrant scare tactics and the caravans and all that.
Exactly. And even on Fox News, I love when, you know, they show the, you know, the clips of, oh, the job numbers just came out and they're like, whoa.
You can see them all looking like, oh.
Yeah. Oh. Right. Exactly.
I love it. So, you know, you worked for the vice president, who I think is a underpriced political stock. I think she's had a very rough go with a lot of the press. And certainly the Republicans are using her as their scary figure, like, oh no, Joe Biden's too old. You're really voting for Harris. But I do think, I want to get your opinion on this. I feel like in the last 2 months or so, she's really gotten her stride and really started to catch a little bit of a new assessment of her as a campaigner. Because look, I wrote about this once before. I'm like, when she ran against Biden, she was a good but not consistent hitter. She could come in occasionally and hit a grand slam home run and everyone would go, wow. And then it would be like batting 125 for the next few times and then another grand slam. I feel like she's starting to get her stride. What do you think? Where do you see that right now?
I agree with you that I think she's 100% hitting her stride. Look, but I would even say that I think she's been there. The perception might not have been there, but I think having been on the inside, I've seen her hit her stride, I think, for a while now. But I think now the public is really starting to come to terms with that, right? And I think she's emerged, especially to your point, right, in these last few months as, you know, the administration's most, and the campaign certainly, most effective ambassador to, you know, voters of color, especially Black voters and young voters, right? I think the issues that you've seen this vice president take up in really big ways include, you know, reproductive freedom. And since the Dobbs decision, I mean, the vice president completely mobilized to, you know, travel this country, which she continues to do on her Fight for Reproductive Freedom tour, where she's meeting with, you know, voters from all across the demographic and, you know, political spectrum and talking about, you know, the what's going on in this country about reproductive freedom in ways that I haven't seen any other politician be able to do. Right. And I think people are starting to see that when it comes to other issues, right, that especially, again, young voters care a lot about. You talk about climate change. You know, the vice president's been hitting the road and traveling to communities that are benefiting from, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act and all these other historic pieces, you know, of legislation. And I think people are really starting to hit her stride. But I think I think on repro, I think that really has become her bread and butter, right? The way that she's able to talk about, you know, that the government, you know, ought not to be telling women what to do with their own bodies. And I think we continue to see how big of an issue repro is going to be, right? In this election cycle, we see it time and time again. We saw it in Alabama earlier this week. And so, you know, I do think that, you know, the campaign is going to continue to lean into the vice president's effective advocacy on that issue and on so many others, which again resonate really, really well with, you know, with young voters especially, and voters of color especially, with, you know, a vice president's on the older side. You know, I think they're really looking to her to you know, speak truth to power for younger voters.
You know, I think one of the things that she has been effective at doing is she's used some of the language. You know, she, look, everyone has seen that this, that the Dobbs decision, the Republican overreach on abortion, and by the way, the side that overreaches is always the side that loses on this issue. The Republican overreach that went way out of control after Dobbs, the IVF thing in Alabama, and how other Republican states want to do the same thing. And now they're basically fighting against birth control in the Supreme Court. And I think she's gotten she had a very smart calibration of message where she's now talking about, like, this is government interfering in your life. This is
correct.
This is big government. This is control of your liberty. And, you know, if you elevate it one step up of just using the word abortion, those Republican women and folks, what people don't know is that traditionally, historically, between 22 and 28% of Republican women in really good, high-quality surveys have been pro-choice. And either they're Roe v. Wade pro-choice, or they're kind of libertarian, government should stay out of my business pro-choice. They might not choose to have an abortion themselves, but they don't want the government to tell you what you can and can't do. That number since Dobbs has expanded about 50%. And the polling isn't as granular, but it's certainly expanded. And we're seeing, as you point out, the impact of this in a place like Alabama. And by the way, the ad that was used in Alabama was a real first. It was in a very red state, a conservative district, a conservative state, where a Democratic woman looks at the camera and says, "I had to have an abortion." And it wasn't the cliche the Republicans think it is, "Oh, you just wanted it for birth control." No, this was a tragedy and a painful story. And I think that's ramifying out there into the country after Dobbs and after all these things. I mean, shit, man, we identified a bunch of new voters in our research of Republican men. We're calling them the Dobbs dads, who are like Gen Xers and millennials who have daughters between the ages of 10 and 25. And these guys hate this stuff. They're like, "You're telling me my daughter gets raped, she can't have an abortion? Is that what you're telling me? F off." But no, I think she's done very well on that.
Yeah, no, I agree. So I have a few things to say. So about the Alabama race, so I was making phone calls for Marilyn Lands, you know, this weekend. I'm from Georgia myself, and I firmly believe that the Democrats cannot sleep on the South, right?
Correct.
And so I was making phone calls for Marilyn Lands, and I was, you know, obviously there's always those who hang up when you know, all of that. But, you know, I was blown away by the number of callers who I spoke with who, you know, "She has my vote 5,000%, you know?
Right.
And the script that they gave us in the calls that we were making addressed reproductive freedom head on, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen in other cases, right, candidates tiptoe around that issue, but Marilyn Lands leaned in full speed ahead. And so I think, you know, that's a district, to your point, Rick, that Donald Trump carried. Marilyn Lands herself lost by 7 points in 2022, and she came back and won it by 25 points. And so I think we just – another sign of Democrats winning – on that issue. And then to the vice president, like you were saying, I think you're so right in that the way that she's made this about freedom and has not just sort of looked at this issue in a vacuum, right? She's looked at and connecting the dots between, you know, this issue as an example of the government trying to restrict, you know, the freedom of women to make decisions about their own body, and other examples in which, you know, the MAGA Republicans, the extremist Republicans, want to strip away at freedom while hypocritically saying that they're the party of freedom. And on hypocrisy, too, you know, she points out, the vice president, all the time that many of the same states with many of the same extremist, you know, Republicans who claim to be all about life, you know, and wanting to be, you know, pro-life, are the same ones who are pushing policies that are worsening the maternal mortality crisis. And right. So that hypocrisy is just so stark, right? If you really care, you know, about promoting and preserving life, then why are you trying to push policies that are leading to women dying? And whether it's Marilyn Lands sharing her own personal story, or the women who I talked to when I was writing for the vice president, who, you know, shared their stories. In one case, a woman in Florida who nearly bled out because she was turned away from going to the hospital when she was having a miscarriage, then had to go to a hair salon where she went to do her hair in preparation for her own funeral so her mother wouldn't have to go take her body, right, to get manicured, and went to the bathroom and had a miscarriage and almost bled out and died. And so I think you're right in that the vice president has just really seen how to talk about this issue. Democrats are winning. I don't want to make it just purely political because these are women's lives that are at stake, but the ways in which, you know, I think we've figured out how to uplift this issue.
It really has. It really has, I think, changed the tone of this argument in the country. And again, a friend of mine is a pretty serious evangelical of the sort of good-hearted evangelical nature. And he said to me, he goes, I don't understand why the cruelty here. I don't understand the cruelty. I don't understand why they, you know, he goes, I've funded adoption centers. I've done all these things. And he goes, now I'm like, these people are insane. They've gone so far over the edge. So, but I think she's done well with that. So I want to talk to you a little bit about where you see the direction of, there's some concern and there is some legitimate concern in polling that young voters have not engaged on this election and that they've been sort of grumpy with Joe Biden about the Hamas, Gaza, Palestine question. And that they have sort of felt like, oh, they're both old men. So what? I'm not going to get involved. I don't care. Where do you see that right now? And how do you see that developing? My personal theory of the case is that they'll be late breakers. They'll come into this a little later in the game. But when they do, I suspect it's going to be a choice. And there, if it is two old men, there's one that's good and one that's evil. So where do you see that?
So, Rick, I think, you know, I think Joe Biden, you know, and his whole administration, I think they've done a lot to make young voters very excited about a second term. We talked earlier about, you know, this administration's historic work to fight the climate crisis. We talked about, you know, the ways in which the president and vice president are talking about the issue of reproductive freedom. You know, we know this president as well tried to take really historic action to relieve those with college debt from the crushing burden mm-hmm. of their college debt. But mm-hmm. because, you know, of Donald Trump appointed Supreme Court justices, those efforts were struck down. And so I do think that there's a lot for young voters to be excited about when it comes to four more years of Joe Biden to build on that work. However, you know, as you pointed out, I do think that what's going on in the Middle East has signaled somewhat of a shift, right, in terms of what we're seeing, you know, when it comes to young voters and how they feel about, you know, four more years of Joe Biden. I do think even on that issue, you're starting to see, and, you know, again, the vice president has really been, you know, very effective at speaking about this issue. You're starting to see shifts in the messaging, you know, from this administration and how it's approaching the situation in the Middle East. A lot is going to change between now and the election. So I think it's really, it's hard for us to sit here and, you know, predict how that all will unfold. But I do agree with you in that I think that a lot of young voters right now are rightfully, you know, demanding more and expecting more from their government. And I think that's characteristic of, you know, my generation. I think a lot of, you know, young people, you know, in all facets of society, but certainly in politics, you know, don't want to settle for, you know, what they perceive as a choice between, you know, two bad options. Now, that's not how I think this election is. I don't think it's a choice between two bad options. I think there are a lot of young people out there who don't think it's a choice between two bad options as well. But I think for those who might, you know, I certainly hope, and I agree with you, certainly through my conversations that I've had with other, you know, young voters, I do think that, you know, when November rolls around, when October rolls around, and, you know, we're faced with the prospect of what this election is going to come down to, and, you know, as young voters see and understand the two radically different visions for the future that these two campaigns are trying to effectuate, right? On one side, you know, it's Joe Biden. You know, it's a future where, you know, we're about expanding freedom, not contracting freedom. It's a future where we're focused on fighting, not denying the climate crisis. It's, you know, a future where we want to get more, not fewer people, you know, enrolled in health insurance. It's a future where, you know, we're pro, not anti-democracy. And on the other side, you see the opposite and the inversion of all of that. And so I think once young voters get to the ballot box or to their absentee ballot, I think they're gonna realize the consequences of the election. And I do believe that a vast majority of them are going to break for Joe Biden.
I think you've got it right. So one other question that I have that is, puzzled a lot of our pollster friends and puzzled a lot of our media friends. There has been a measurable, not huge, not catastrophic, measurable drift among African-American men and Hispanic men towards the Republicans, towards Trump. What do you see the drivers of that as being? And how can the campaign this year start to mitigate that? I mean, the numbers are real. We can't deny, we can't say they're not there. They are there. Where do you see that standing? And what do you think the remedy on that is?
So I don't want to deny the numbers, Rick. I definitely don't want to deny the numbers. But I think I take a somewhat more critical stance on some of the prevailing narratives, I think, around this realignment that many pollsters and political scientists have been talking about, right? We know that since the 1960s, since LBJ signed, the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, that, Black voters from then were solidly Democratic, sure. Right? And mm-hmm. since 1960, no GOP candidate has won more than 13% of the Black vote.
Donald
right?
Trump won 8% last time. Yep.
No, exactly. Exactly, right? And I think that was an improvement over like 6 or
yes,
6 or 7.
Yes, it was 6 the first, that, his, right? first, his yeah. first election. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's worth remembering, and even, even in that election, right, in 2020, we didn't really see Black men defect from Joe Biden to Donald Trump. We didn't really see a mass defection of, of Black men, of Hispanic men, right? And so I think it's worth first starting from that fact, which is that Black voters are, solidly Democratic. I do know we have seen polls that have suggested that, there might be something going on, but I look at, the election results that we've seen since 2020. I have yet to see, and, correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, I have yet to see, a midterm result in terms of exit polling. I've yet to see, any primaries in the, any GOP primary so far that has signaled a mass exodus, right, of Black voters, of Black men, because we know Black women are solid, even more solidly Democratic, but, we haven't really seen, I have yet to see a real election result since 2020 that would give me the sort of concern in concluding that, to conclude that the Democratic Party, that Joe Biden is bleeding support among Black men. However, I think we'll have to wait and see what happens in the fall. But I think what we might see a, a moderate sort of, small to moderate defection of Black men, Hispanic male voters. I am looking at, but I would characterize it perhaps more as what I, what some political scientists have called more, not as much a realignment, but perhaps more of an ideological sorting. In that we know that, Black voters as a whole, Hispanic voters, and I don't know how widely this is really understood sort of beyond, these communities, is that, those voters tend to be more socially conservative, right?
Right.
On a number of issues. And so I think to the extent that we are seeing some ideological sorting, it could be more a function of the fact that, voters of color have historically, like I said, since 1960, been voting for Democrats, but perhaps in opposition to some social values that they actually might harbor themselves. And so it could be what we're seeing is that some of those voters are actually realizing, hey, I actually align more with the Republican Party. We're a lot further away from the civil rights era, right, today.
I think that distance is a big
yeah,
factor.
That distance is big. So they're not identifying as strongly the Democratic Party with, the party of civil rights or the party that's in line with their best interests. Now, so I think that could be something that we see playing out, but I feel confident about sort of where, this campaign, the Biden campaign, is with Black voters, with Hispanic voters. However, it's going to be incumbent upon the campaign to make sure that it continues to go out to those communities and amplify, right, the work that it's been doing to deliver for those communities. Because, being in DC where I was, I lived that, right? I was helping craft the talking points and the speeches about that. But on the outside, a lot of people just don't know. And we've seen focus group after focus group that reveals that when, especially Black voters learn about a lot of the work that this administration has done to close the racial wealth gap, to create, Black jobs for Black folks, to help incentivize Black small business creation. They're like, wow, this is amazing. And so the campaign is going to have to continue to do that, to continue to get out there, amplify the work that they've been doing. And I think we'll be in solid footing.
I like it. I like it. Well, Gevin Reynolds, thank you so much for coming on the Enemies List today. I really appreciate your time. And it was a very enjoyable conversation. Where can people find you on social media?
So you can find me on Instagram, on X or Twitter, at Gevin Reynolds. Right. You can find it just at Gevin Reynolds.
All right. Very good. Well, let's have you on the show again soon before the election. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Hey, thanks again, Rick. Take care.
I am not the greatest Christian you'll ever meet. I have a, to put it mildly, fairly distant relationship with that matter. But I do know one thing. I know if you are a corrupt, venal, obese, profligate, sinful, abusive, cretinous, vile, low, amoral, shitbird, scumbag named Donald Trump, the last fucking thing you should be doing is selling a Bible. The last thing you should be doing is hawking a Bible with your branding on it. The last thing on earth you should be doing is promoting the Donald Trump, where we go one, we go all, God bless America, Lee Greenwood, whatever the hell it is, Bible. This, for anybody out there who is a Christian, you're looking at this and thinking, this is normal, this is okay, this is fine, this is what I believe in. I've now put Donald Trump on parallel with Jesus Christ, then you are begging to be struck by lightning. You are begging to be cast into being a pillar of salt. You are begging to be struck down and reprimanded by whatever deity you believe in. This is an astounding affront. And it's been a long topic of conversation in this country about the evolution of particularly evangelical Christians into believing in a cult of Trump. But if you believe that a Bible branded by Donald Trump is the word of God and not a temptation into sin and corruption, you are on the enemies list. Thanks again for listening to The Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.